Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for staying, and I know it's us and soon lunchtime, so I hope you're not falling asleep here before you get some food. We will be quite prompt with timing, but we will leave some time to ask questions after the panelists have been talking. So please, if you have any questions, sit on them, and we will open the floor for questions afterwards. So my name is Anna Stablum. I'm super happy to be here today with you and to moderate this panel. I think this is a really interesting panel, especially because of a lot of criticism, of course, in the voluntary carbon market space. And we'll touch upon a little bit how you actually pick a project, how you get this project off the ground, and what type of financing methods that you will be faced with or that you can choose from. We have heard a little bit about tightness of supply in the panels yesterday, and I think the two people that got on stage here has got a massive job ahead of them to actually be able to fulfill the supplies. If it's going to go to Article 6 markets or if it's going to go into voluntary, and of course Climeco as well, we're a project developer. We've been working with industrial industries for a long time, since 2009. So we're doing a lot of N2O, so nitrous oxide abatement projects. We're working with the shipping industry to try and install retrofits in the old fleets. And we're also doing low carbon cement, so we're writing our own methodologies to try and really help the industries, especially the hard to abate industries, decarbonize by tapping on the funding from the voluntary carbon markets. So I'm not going to take too much more time. I will let my panelists introduce themselves, and then we got a few questions that we will go and dig deeper into, and then of course we will have questions from the floor. So please, if you guys want to start.
Yeah, I'll start first. Thanks very much, Anna. My name is Law Heng Din. I'm currently with Pollination. So Pollination is a climate-focused consulting and investment company. So we, in terms of carbon markets, we actually advise clients, you know, about how to think about carbon markets, how to navigate the complexities and challenges. But we also invest into projects and develop some of our own projects as well in Pakistan and a few other countries. Prior to Pollination, I was actually with Temasek for 11 years, helped set up a vehicle called Gen Zero that invests into decarbonization and carbon markets.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. So Min Tran here. Work with Sequest here in Singapore. So I'm heading up the sales and BD in the region, as well as looking after our energy and natural resources clients. So for those of you I don't know, Sequest is a project developer. We have different asset classes, predominantly cook stoves, looking at NBS removal, LEDs, as well as methane leaks in sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, South Asia, as well as Latin America. And interestingly, so we have many investors. I think I'll touch upon this through the panel. But, one of them being Gen Zero, and I think that happened at the time of Heng Din, so small world.
That's good. So of course, you can ask yourself, if you're a corporate sitting in this room, voluntary carbon markets, full reputational risk, regulation that's in its infancy, no price transparency, no futures, as we heard, and most things, of course, seems to still be in flux in relation to standards and what is a good enough credit for our organization. So you do sit and ask yourself, I'm sure, why would anyone want to get involved in this market? And why should you get involved in this market? Do you mind giving us a little bit of your view, Dean Heng?
Yeah, thanks, Anna. So, I mean, that's a very good question. That's a question that we get a lot, you know, from clients, from partners. If you look at it from a global perspective, I mean, the way the world is going in terms of global warming, obviously we are going the wrong direction, or we're not doing the right thing fast enough. So nature is going to be an important component of getting things back on track. But, you know, how do you enable that? You need money. Governments, through philanthropic money, is not going to be enough. you need a private sector to come in. And that's one of the reasons why carbon markets were set up to begin with, to basically to channel some of these mainstream financing into, you know, protection, restoration of vulnerable ecosystems benefiting local communities. So that is, I mean, from a, how you say, from an altruistic level, this is something that we should be doing in terms of looking at carbon markets, in terms of looking at nature-based solutions. I guess from the company's perspective, obviously, I think we'll look at it from a more commercial point of view. And the fundamental fact is that most companies are not decarbonizing or not reducing emissions fast enough. Increasingly, the large companies have set 2030 as well as countries, you know, based on this agreement as the first milestone. Given the lack of progress, they will need to look at carbon markets likely in some form or the other. The question is what kind of credits? And I think that's what is probably the issue right now. Do you navigate the issues and challenges? A lot of companies, I mean, they look at the media articles, they look at the negative press, and basically that conclusion is, I'll just wait and see, you know, let things settle down, you know, which is a good enough reason and a good enough rationale for seeing on the sidelines. But the thing is, I think we all seen how complicated and how complex the market is. So to a certain extent, for some of these companies that can probably take a longer term view and be a bit more patient, probably the best way to understand what is going on is to learn by doing. You know, understand what are the issues, maybe invest in a portfolio, a diversified portfolio of projects, you know, to reduce your risk. But that is probably one of the, you know, better ways of actually getting your feet wet and understanding the issues firsthand. You don't need to devote a lot of resources. You don't need to devote like, you know, $100 million, $1 billion worth of capital to invest into, you know, large scale MBS projects. But, you know, together, collectively, if enough comes come together, basically take a diversified approach, collectively we may be able to make a difference. And as things settle down, yeah, hopefully more capital can come in. But long and short of it is that, you know, companies as well as countries, we are not decarbonizing fast enough. And that's the reality. And carbon markets is one of the important measures that's gonna help address this particular challenge.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that you're talking about how do you navigate, of course, which types of credits and how you should get involved. But I think learning by doing is really the... And we are seeing companies that are moving in small and basically they are learning by doing. But I mean, why is it so important to actually not take the wait and see approach? Because of course we are seeing that a lot as well with companies. I think 92% of companies that are listed globally have actually not even set a net zero commitment yet. So there's a lot of people and companies and executives out there are taking this wait and see approach. Why can you not do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I could not agree more with what Hengdin just mentioned. In terms of not being able to wait and see, you know, if we look at the numbers, I think they finished compiling the emission numbers from here. I think it was around 38 billion tons. It was the highest ever in the history of the world. It's about 1% above 2022, 2% above pre-pandemic. So essentially we keep going up and up. And of course, we know we have a finite carbon budget. And so clearly the business as usual way of working is not fast enough or not ambitious enough when it comes to fighting climate change. So then it comes down to what can we do, right? And so we hear that narrative, I think, being pushed out of direct emission reduction versus indirect emission reduction, i.e. offsetting, and saying we should do one or the other. And I think in Europe especially, it's a very prevailing narrative. I think from where we stand, because of the it's just because of the clock ticking and the carbon budget becoming depleted, we have to do both. When it comes to direct emission reduction, we actually see that, when it comes to that narrative, we actually see that those that do one tend to do the other. I think a very good example would be if we look at the investors of Sequest. So we have Macquarie, we have Vision Ridge, which are more financial institutions, but we also have JVs with Shell and BP. I think that reflects a position that was taken in the oil and gas industry, where they are very actively trying to decarbonize through all means available. I think what they realize is that direct emission reduction has a good narrative, but it's risky, it's expensive. There's only a limited opportunity pool. You cannot do it everywhere. The risk, the management risk, the asset risk is high, and of course, there's a cost associated to it. I know we talk a lot about CCS, CCUS. I spent a lot of time working on this, and you know, we're talking about numbers ranging from $100 to $250 per ton. Now, on the other hand, you have offset direct indirect emission reduction, which is essentially applying the theory of specialization to decarbonization. So can I outsource my decarbonization activities to the person that can do it the most efficiently at scale with lowest cost and with a faster learning curve? And I think this is where we see offsetting being very appealing, with, of course, the caveat of the very healthy debate around integrity. So I think, you know, looking at where we are now, offsetting seems to take a bigger and bigger part in the network because the deadline is approaching. And from the point of view of investors, the current down cycle is a great opportunity to essentially buy at a discount. So I think we're hoping to see some renewed interest in the coming 12 months, both from buyers, but as well as from investors.
Thanks for that. And I think as well, I think we will have responsibility to build that market as well. There's been a lot of talk, of course, from some groups that are encouraging, of course, the mitigation hierarchy and that we should build on basically the direct emissions and start there, which is fine. And then, of course, as we come closer to 2050, we will take away the residual emissions with removals. But I think sometimes that's also another argument to not sit around and wait, because if we don't even have a market by 2045, where are you going to get those removal credits from? And I think that's something that we all need to kind of start building at this point of time, so that there will be enough projects, enough removal credits out there when we start to come to closer to 2050 and even 2030. So with that, and if we are expecting, which we are, more companies that exactly what you were touching upon as well, putting a strategy in place, and part of that strategy is offsets. We need to, of course, as project developers, ramp up these projects. So Climco has produced around 30 million tons of credits up until this point. So that's from 2009. That's actually just half of Singapore's annual emissions. And that's been taking us some time. This is not a market that is ramping up quickly from a supply side point of view. And I think that's also something that we really need to see buyers today realize, that if we're not supporting the market today, we will never have supplies needed when we get closer to our target years of 2030 and 2050. So with that, I would like to ask you at Pollination, Dean Heng, how do you get your projects off the ground?
I'll talk a bit more from a general context, and also obviously from my past experiences looking at projects from an investment perspective in my previous roles. I think if you talk about getting, and I'll talk a bit more from a nature-based perspective, because that's what I'm a bit more familiar with. I think end of the day, if you talk about nature-based projects, you know, this would range from forestry, grasslands management, possibly even agricultural credits. End of the day, the people element, it sounds a bit, esoteric, but end of the day, it is very much a people's business. If you want to protect the ecosystem, you got to start with the people. And you need to get the buy-in from whichever community or stakeholders we're talking about. And that is probably the most difficult thing to do. The technical challenges we are well aware of, the methodologies are not perfect, but that's being addressed at this point. And will there ever be perfect? Probably not. But at least the standards are recognized that things need to be done. Questions need to be answered. But when it comes to getting the projects off the ground, in terms of getting the buy-in from communities, you know, that's very key because it's not like monoculture, it's not like farming, it's not like mining where you're dealing with a very concrete product here. So when you talk to communities, villagers, you know, anywhere, I mean, especially in the global south, it's hard to explain to them, and this is based on my experiences talking with them, it's hard for developers to basically explain to them what they're actually doing. So, but developers who are going for the right reasons, you know, taking a long-term view, don't see carbon as a, you know, get-rich-quick kind of scheme, who understands the basically some of these issues dealing with communities, dealing with other stakeholders, I think this kind of projects would have the chance of getting off the ground and over time succeeding. So we have a partner in a project in Pakistan. This is the Delta Blue project, where we are working with our Pakistani partners to help restore 300,000 hectares of mangroves. So this is the world's largest mangrove project. And fundamentally, it's a people project. People like mangrove projects because people think there's a lot of co-benefits, but you know, this biodiversity, helping to address rising sea levels, all that is well and fine. But fundamentally, if you think about it, a lot of the damage done to these ecosystems were unfortunately carried out by communities because of a lack of economic choices. Therefore, if you want to prevent the damage or restore the damage, you probably have to talk to the same people. Yeah. So there's no magic silver bullet. But you know, you have to start very much understanding what's on the ground. Benefit sharing, that's another important thing. Yeah, to make sure the communities, and not just the community leaders, I mean the communities themselves, basically understand what they're getting into and understand they're getting a fair share. It is complicated. Nothing is easy. But if you get it right, there are examples in Asia and elsewhere whereby community-based, nature-based projects have actually made a difference to climate as well as to local livelihoods. Yeah.
Thanks for that. I think that is it is very important, especially in the MBS space, to see it from a community perspective, that it's not just about carbon. This is much wider than carbon. This is biodiversity. This is communities that you're working with, and that makes it so complex, and it also means that it's a lot of time. These stakeholder engagements and understanding exactly who even to talk to in these certain regions, and to make sure that you're talking to everyone from the fishing villages to the people at the top of the country to really establish these projects. But again, it's a reminder to buyers how hard it is to really create these kind of projects. I wanted to talk to you, Min, on the role basically of financing and investors in this space, because it does seem, of course, as well, we're having a wide range of projects, and some projects like afforestation projects will take a long time to actually get any type of credits. Even mangroves will take at least 3-4 years. So you need to have a lot of patient money in some of these type of projects, whereas there are other projects that you can actually get some credits at least after a year or two. Do you mind sharing a little bit of your experience when you talk to investors, what type of project that might suit their profile?
So I think to give you a sense, so we've raised about $450 million in equity for different projects and prepay on top of this. So this is kind of the order of magnitude on which I'm going to base what I'm going to say. In the carbon space, it's important to note that there is no debt financing. And to some extent, everybody who finances a project has skin in the game. What we find is that there is a very wide array of different type of financiers, especially so when you're looking at a diversified portfolio when it comes to asset classes and geographies. Now, at a conceptual level, it does come down to two questions. First one is, what do the financiers want? Second is, what level of risk and exposure are they willing to take in order to get what they want? And then getting what they want in itself split to what do they want in terms of product, meaning you know, production profile, volume, timeline, uncertainty, risk, and then what do they want in terms of financial returns? And of course, financial returns being IRR and PV, and again, essentially timing and money. Depending on what they want and on their level of comfort around risk and exposure, they will likely focus on different asset classes as well as different financing mechanism. So if I can touch on the financing mechanism, they're fairly common. You know, it's moving from investment at the corporate level to portfolio level to project level to tolling facility and then prepayment on the project. So very similar to what you could find in the oil and gas industry or other commodities industry. In terms of asset class, I think you pointed right at it, right? There's a big difference between avoidance and removal. For example, even within the same company, we can see a part of the company being willing to invest in NBS removal for the purpose of their own retirement, because what they focus on is integrity, price is not much of an issue. They have a 2030 and 2050 target, so they're willing to wait for the volumes to start to plateau in the NBS removal towards 2028, 2029. On the other hand, if they're looking after, if the other part, let's say the trading of the business, wants to make money off of a price spread or get exposed to either price upside or capture a price discount at the time of purchase, then they might be more interested in avoidance. In our case, there would be a lot of cook stoves. For other developers, I know Red Plus is very attractive because, again, avoidance is kind of immediate. So at the end of the day, there's no hard and fast rules. I think what's very important for us as developers when we talk to the market is to understand, as I said, what do they want, level of risk are they willing to take, and then third one, which I did not mention earlier, would be what are the synergies that they can extract in their core business. So how does that augment their core business beyond just the net zero claim? Are there ways for them to increase the competitiveness of their core product? And I think in the commodity space, during that conference, we've seen that a lot of the traders or a lot of the players in the ecosystem are more and more starting to look at carbon products as a synergistic play to essentially just extract more value.
Thanks for that. That's very interesting. And just to add a little bit on that, because we work with a lot of the hard to abate industries and we work with the companies. So how we basically finance a lot of our projects that work on is that the company would have to make the upfront investment. So for example, when we work with the shipping industry, so like I said, we have got now credits with Gold Standard. So there would be a shipping owner who is interested in doing retrofits. They will have to do the initial investment themselves in the retrofits, and we will measure the ship because we have now a model that we've been working with MIT. So the MIT has basically provided us with a green screen model that we have, and we put in the information about the ship before the retrofits and then after their retrofits were installed. So the savings that they make from having these retrofits installed will basically be measured, and we will issue carbon credits. We go to market with these carbon credits and we give the revenue back to the ship owner. It means that the payback time for these installments will be a lot shorter. And of course, they're also making savings, the fact that they're actually saving in the fuel costs. So we're seeing just an additional way of basically spurring innovation. You need to be going above business as usual. It can't be retrofits that are already quite heavily used by the shipping sector. It needs to be going above and beyond business as usual. And that's when you can tap on the voluntary carbon markets for finance, which is very popular and is something that we've done with the shipping industry, like I said, with the chemical industry. And we're looking at low carbon cement. And this year we will be targeting the steel sector. So basically trying to find ways to finance new innovation and to really make these companies see that it's worthwhile on their balance sheet to make these upfront investments, and then they will get money back from the carbon market. But of course, when we come to these companies and we suggest these solutions, it all comes down to, of course, the price of each every carbon credit. And that's something, of course, that you are faced with as well when you're presenting a cook stove project or you're presenting an
all of a sudden the price of these carbon credits matter. And if we are not being paid enough for the shipping credits in this case, or for the MBS or for the cook stoves, then it makes sense. So again, this is something that is really important, especially when we've seen these headwinds to the voluntary carbon markets. We will not get projects off the ground if the price is not right. And again, we need demand really to come in and support that, and buyers to understand that. So our time is soon up. I just want to ask you for the outlook and what you're hoping for this year and the opportunities that you're seeing.
For carbon markets in particular, I think probably cautiously optimistic. I think we are seeing the market again address some of the controversies and negative press. I think a lot of people are pinning their hopes on the core carbon principles making a difference, because then that provides a clearer indicator of quality. But even so, I don't think there's any one single silver bullet. I think that that's in that regard, I think things may need some time to settle down. You know, even if a CCP issued, it doesn't mean that, you know, suddenly all the prices are going to increase by two or three times. But, you know, it's a process. You know, VCMI with its criteria, hopefully that will make a difference, make it easier for companies to figure out how their claims as well. So, yeah, hopeful, but, you know, it's going to take a bit of time, I suspect.
Well, I think for us, we're hoping that 2024 is going to be better than 2023, hopefully a recovery year, potentially with a cleanup of the market when it comes to integrity, as well as better alignment and management of expectations. I think CCP label will play a big role in this. On the A6 government side, I think we're all hoping to see some LOAs come true. Certainly for us, something we're working on and hoping to get a view by the end of H1. But we are very far from a, you know, fully functional A64 or A62 world. I think for as a project developer, what's a bit tough is where you deploy your capital. Because as I said, right, there's no debt financing. We still need to invest. Question is, where do you invest? Do you wait for the new methodologies, let's say on cook stove, to be clarified? You start doing it now. We do NBS removal projects, but long-term pricing on those is quite difficult as well, and methodology is also uncertain. So I think our view is to say, you know, let's take a stab at what the future is going to be made of. So we've decided, okay, we want to have a very differentiated value proposition built around hopefully integrity as well as community engagement and let's say social development in general. And then from there, just stick to our guns and try to lead at least that space within the carbon market. But I would say the wait and see approach is probably the one that I would, just as a developer, I would avoid just for fear of, you know, wasting resources and also being pummeled by news and cover and article coverage, and then just doubts in the market.
Right. With that, we will open the floor to questions, if there are any questions. There's a mic coming. One second.
Sorry. Paul Zaman, could you give me an idea of the scale in dollars or whatever of the projects? You know, is there, what's the smallest one and what's the biggest one? Maybe you've done to date.
I mean, so for example, we have, it depends, right? So if I take, depends which asset class we're talking about, NBS removal is going to be much more expensive than cook stoves. So the operational cost can be multiples. In our case, we're dealing with, you know, anywhere between 50 to 100 mil for investment. Now, for 100 million, it wouldn't be a single project typically, because in our case, I'd say we would have two or three projects that cover multiple households over a region, let's say in sub-Saharan Africa. But yeah, we're talking about those order of magnitude.
Again, I'll speak more from the perspective of nature-based solutions. The scale to a certain extent is determined by the cost needed to certify the credits, which unfortunately now is a bit expensive. You know, they range in a couple of $1,000, for instance. So you hardly would see projects that cover a few hundred hectares, for instance, be it forestry or agriculture or whatever. It's not cost efficient, plus given the markets where they are right now. But on the other end of the scale, increasingly, as Min has mentioned, this is going to be an Article 6 world where we talk about transactions between countries. And countries are coming in to issue projects themselves, jurisdictional credits. We're talking about covering, you know, countries or provinces. You talk about millions, if not tens of millions of credits. So it ranges from the fairly small, but, you know, subject to the certification costs, to country level kind of scale. So again, it ranges. Yeah,
and for the credits, we're doing quite small projects as well because we're working with a lot of different types. But exactly what the two gentlemen said, it really comes down to the cost of issuance. So we need to have enough scale to make it worthwhile per unit, because otherwise, and I think for gold standard, I think it's around $60,000 to just have one kind of issuance. So you need to have quite a lot of credits to make it worthwhile.
Hi, I'm just wondering, when you have funded projects, how do you negotiate the agreement given that nation states or regions are now starting to take ownership of their own credits? The agreement between the investor, the corporation, and then the nation state or the region, and who gets what credits out of the project?
So from our perspective at this point of time, we haven't really come across yet how that could look like, because we don't know, we don't have any projects where we have seen already that the government is taking over or that won't have a share. But we have a project in Indonesia, for example, and we know that the Indonesian government will take a certain amount of those credits, which again comes back to the question of how many credits will we then be able to have in that project to make it economically viable. And I think at this point of time, it's very uncertain because they haven't actually put a fixed number, but there's anything from 10 to 30% that the Indonesian government will take for their own NDCs, which really means that you need to have quite a large project in Indonesia to make it worthwhile. And the fact is that we don't know the rule of the game yet, but it could be that smaller projects in Indonesia will struggle just because, and it depends a little bit which type of project, because different sectors will take different. It depends which sector that you will land under. But it's definitely making it harder if you have smaller projects.
Maybe if we could just add, I think from an investor's point of view, you build in buffers. You know, it could be 20-30%. And if you're a bit more conservative, you slap something additional on top of that. The rules are evolving, but I think what Indonesia is doing in terms of, although the numbers are not exact yet, but that's going to be the trend around the world, be it nature or technical kind of projects. The government will want to make sure that their NDC goals are not affected. So as investors, as buyers, that is something that we will have to deal with regardless.
I think looking a bit broad, just the NDCs, my feeling is that the governments, that they're not going to reinvent the wheel. So essentially what we are seeing, and that's Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, is that they're pulling the oil and gas and the mining playbook on taxation, and then either getting paid so it can be, you know, licensed, it can be, could be PSC agreement, could be service agreement. So it's a way for them to essentially monetize, leverage the capability and service of private corporations in order to monetize what they see as being natural resources, that being oil, iron ore, or land, or even carbon credits. Then it's, how do they get paid? Do they get paid in kind, or do they get paid in cash? And if they get paid in kind, are there any rules around the what defines the kind? So do they want only high integrity credits that would qualify for a CORSIA compliance so that they can give it to their own, let's say, national airline? Or is it just they want more of the cheaper credits because they want to make sure that the domestic companies can decarbonize at the lowest cost and not impede their competitiveness at the global level? So all of this is still uncertain, and discussions with many governments are at their premise. But I think from investor point of view, what we're doing is being very transparent with potential investors as to what it could be, what we know, what we don't know. And then essentially it's just working out how we share the risk based on the equity stakes as well as the rights that come with the respective equity stakes.
Actually, just a follow-up question. So I was thinking about whether insurance can be introduced to carbon market to address the variety of risk, as you mentioned. Yeah, for example, nowadays people not only talk about insurance like protect them from forest fire ruining the project, but also negative media report, methodology changes, and supply shrinks. So what's your view of, in general, having an insurance in carbon market? If so, what are the necessary function in your view? Yeah, thanks.
I have looked at this issue previously. My own personal view about insurance, although there are products starting to come out right now, my own view about insurance, or more broadly risk management, again, you start with the projects, be it technical or nature, manage the project, not just conservatively, but you know, on a considered basis. There will be risk finding ways. I mean, then you have to figure out as an investor or as a buyer or as a developer to figure out a way to mitigate those risks. Obviously, there could be a time whereby insurance could come in. But fundamentally, again, it starts with the project, how you certify, how you manage, how you operate, so on and so forth. I think there could be a role to play, but I suspect it might be early days. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the main barrier, and we kind of touched upon it in the previous panel around derivatives, is the lack of volume, lack of liquidity, not enough standardization, you can't build derivatives. So the whole risk management game and creating vehicles, investment vehicles and financial products around it, it's just not mature enough. I think once we reach that stage, then naturally an insurance sector specifically for carbon projects will evolve. It will be different for NBS versus industrial removal versus, let's say, technology avoidance. But I think for me, it's more of a function of economic scale and maturity.
Any other questions? Oh, then I think we also just on time lunch. So thank you very much for staying behind and enjoy your lunch. And thanks to the panelists for such an interesting discussion. Thank you.